overflowing with love. I am overflowing with happiness. I am filled with the power to make a change, to create a brand new life. I am overflowing.
Welcome to the podcast of the Sunday Celebration from the Center for Spiritual Living in Huntsville, Alabama. We hope you feel the grace, the beauty, and the love of our community as you hear the message of the week.
So good morning, and thank you for joining us today. If you're out there in virtual world, you're probably watching this at a later date. Our live streaming had some technical difficulties this morning, and so I am grateful that we have those that have showed up here wearing their masks. And for those of you out there in virtual world, there's a way to access this talk later. I think it's either on YouTube or Facebook, or maybe both. But having said that, I invite you to consciously move into the sacred moment by placing your attention on your breath and the silence that's all around us, and it's within us. And my Zen calendar yesterday was Meister Eckhart, and he said, awake every morning with a beginner's mind. And so I'm going to invite you to allow the beginner's mind to take up residence within you. A beginner's mind is the opposite of an expert's mind. An expert's mind has all the answers, has everything figured out, and wants to be a voice of opinion. But the beginner's mind is, by its very nature, teachable and curious. And as we enter into curiosity, there's another doorway called fascination. And we move into fascination. And then we can hang out in a place called wonder and awe. And the mystery of life begins to reveal itself to us, not as a content filled with information and facts, but as a context, a spaciousness that is within us and all around us, and we begin to tune into that spaciousness. It's as if you were a deep sea diver and you dove from the surface of the water down through the blue, clear, liquid environment, and you discovered a world that you didn't know was there. And so with fascination and curiosity and a beginner's mind, you begin to journey in this uncharted territory, no specific destination, because the journey is the destination, to be fully present. If you're underwater, you're probably not breathing, you're holding your breath. But if you're sitting here with me in virtual world, you can breathe in and out of your lungs, just like a fish would use its gills to breathe in and out, as a fish would do. We are swimming in the ocean of life. And we're not identifying as our separate self so much as an energy, an awake energy that's showing up for the moment, and we're present with what is. And so we're meeting life in its most elemental way, not as a complicated equation filled with emotional issues and mental constructs, but we're meeting life just by being here now. And as Nisargadatta said, at this stage of our evolution, the only thought that really serves is the thought I am. So I invite you to invoke the name of God, the I Am, And just be fascinated with what I am is. I am the space, the holding space. I am the love that knows no other. I am the peace that passes all understanding. I am the joy of life, the joie de vivre. I am nobody, Emily Dickinson. Who are you? Are you nobody too? She said, ah, then there's a pair of us. How boring, she thinks, to be somebody. How public, like a frog, to spend your livelong day on an admiring bog. So Emily found her nobodiness. And then the wisdom, beyond being a somebody, can awaken. Eckhart Tolle speaks of the no mind that operates through our local mind. But the difference is the no mind doesn't have an agenda, whereas the local mind gets oftentimes stuck in concepts, beliefs, opinions, judgments, a narrative, a story, a history, a herstory. But the no mind just hangs out in the om of the universe. And so I invite you to explore, be fascinated by this no mind, this infinite mind, this mind that precedes all thought and is not identified with thought, but yet thought arises within it. The more skillful we become at experiencing the stillness, the more peaceful we become. And then when the storm is all around us, and even the storm clouds appear in the mind, we don't identify with the storm clouds. We know ourselves as the sky in which it arises, that vast, spacious field of awareness is what all of us are. So feeling this awareness as our true nature, I'm going to invite you to symbolically place your head in your heart. Now we can see the head descending into the heart, or we can see the heart arising into the head. Metaphorically, in Buddhism, they call this the bodhicitta, the heart mind, an open heart, and yet a quiet mind. So you're fully awake, you're conscious, you're fully present, and yet you're not hanging out in a bunch of tumbling thoughts like acrobats that go on and on and on. You're just humming along in that silent place, feeling the presence that we all share. I hear that simple little chant in my heart that says, be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am. Be still and know that I am God. Be still and know. Just hanging out in that knowing is so delicious. I'm going to invite you to put your hands over your heart now. The heart mind is all ensconced within us, and we're ready to do some exploring, some discovery of the truth that unhides itself from within. And we invite this truth this Sunday morning to teach us and show us the way. When you're ready, open your eyes, open your hands, let your little heart shimmer. You know, I love to play games. It says in the Bible, Jesus says, I think it's reputed, you know, it's all hearsay, but he said that to be like a child if you would enter the kingdom of heaven. And I remember as a little kid, I would hear that and I'd say, of course, because little children are playful, they're spontaneous, they have wonder and awe. They can have conversations with bugs and flowers, and they don't see themselves as superior, but they can get right on their level. And so what if when we grow up, we could let go of our seriosity and we could recapture that innocence of a child, that discovery process, that sense of wonder and awe. And then life speaks to us in a language that is magical. And we were talking about flying dreams in our revealing service, and as people were sharing, I remembered as a little boy, I used to love Peter Pan, was my favorite fantasy story. And as a little kid, I thought, of course you can fly. All you have to do is think lovely thoughts and then you'll fly. For a little kid, it wasn't hard to imagine all that. But when you get to be an adult, all of a sudden, oh, that's silly. But what if we're talking something so much greater? Is the ability to lift ourselves out of our limited thinking. And Marie was talking about the power of positive thinking. And when you see something, you can achieve it. Oftentimes, when I was a dancer years ago, you would play a certain role in a musical. And once the choreography was established within your body, and then the music would play and you'd be on stage left, and once that certain note was hit, all you had to remember was step left. It's just the foot you step on, and then the dance would unfold itself within you. And what was so neat about that experience was you move past the idea of the doer. I wasn't doing the dance was doing me. And if you were with other dancers, we were all in a collective, creative something, and it was a mystery. So spirituality is kind of the same way. You think you got it all figured out, and when you think you got it all figured out, there's no hope for anything new to come in. So the greatest thing about learning, I learned at 31 years of ministry, is about unlearning. That we don't think we don't, when we know we don't have the answers, then we can be teachable. So one of the wonderful things we can do is we can investigate our Dharma, investigate the truths that we hold so dear to our heart. This Sunday, I'm speaking about seeing with new eyes and how essential it is to see with new eyes. Mark Nepo has a new book out called Living from the Soul. And I was perusing that book last night, and one of the chapters was to see the world with fresh eyes. Similar idea, fresh eyes. And he tells the story of being a college professor, and he was teaching the world's religions. And one of the students stood up, and she was a Christian minister. And she was sharing with him and her interfaith meetings with all the different religions. She finds it so refreshing. She said, I'm hearing the rabbi speak a language that I never heard. And then I hear the imam teaching me the wisdom of surrendering to Allah. And there's so many similarities in these global religions. And then all of a sudden, she said, my dogma starts to crank up. Well, they haven't accepted Jesus as their prayer. And as soon as my dogma creeped up, I couldn't receive the fresh input that they were giving me. I was making them wrong and me right. And so he tells this story because he says, sometimes we don't see what is, we see who we are. So could we have the willingness to see things differently, to look at them with soft eyes? I was listening to the pundits around this election that we're having, and that whole idea of pro-life is emerging stronger than ever as an issue in this country. And it was very interesting. I saw the head of the Republican Party, Michael Steele, saying, you know, we Republicans are pro-life as long as that life is in the womb. But once that life gets out of the womb, we change our tune. And I thought, how painfully, tragically funny and true that is. So could we be willing, no matter where our party affiliation is the willingness to see and question our own doctrine, our own dogma, how that dogma sometimes gets in the way of the evolution of our species. And I think this is all about evolution and consciousness. You know, I've been a religious science minister for a very long time, and Ernest Holmes in The Science of Mind, he talks about involution and evolution as the core. We have to evolve within, and when we evolve, then the world evolves. We can't do it any other way. Mark Nepo, in that lovely little book on soul, he said, we can only see as far into the world as we can see into ourselves. Huh. We can only see as far into the world as we see into ourselves. So could we be willing to do the work and look within? You know, look within. I've taught so many books on awakening, this true nature within us. And I love to share that it was Locke Kelly that said there's three aspects of awakening. There is that which is already awake within us, and that wakes up. You could call it the Buddha consciousness that says, it's not me, there's something greater than me, and it awakens. Jesus called it the Father within. He called it the kingdom of heaven. He said, seek it first. It begins to awaken. And then you realize it was never about you. It was always about that something that is awake already. Call it the Christ consciousness, the Buddha consciousness. We all have it. It awakens when it's ready to awaken, and not any sooner. So you don't do the awakening. It awakens naturally. Oftentimes it takes a crisis. It takes a tragedy. It takes a near-death experience. You know, it takes that 2x4 of life. This thing wakes up. I had a heart attack. Boy, that's a awakening experience, I tell you. It makes you treasure every moment of your life. The second awakening, he says, is the awakening in, and that's where the work comes in. That's where we question our belief system. We question the tyranny of our story. You know, we question our emotional body when it wants to take us on a roller coaster ride. And instead of trying to make it wrong, we start to listen as we awaken within. This stuff is arising to be met. And I'm going to share a little later successful ways we can meet it, because we're in turbulent times right now. We're in very dark times. So instead of seeing these dark times as frightening times, could we change the way we see the darkness and see it as the birth canal? I love to quote the Bible, the very first words of the Bible in reference to the darkness, because the very first words of the King James Bible, and that's the one I'm familiar with, says, in the beginning, God. So in the beginning, all there was this hum of the universe, not a man in the sky. In the beginning, God. And it says, and darkness was on the face of the earth. So it says to me that darkness is the face of creation. And God said, let there be light. Now the light was the Shekinah, was the light within. The sun wasn't created till, I think, the fourth day. So what if out of these dark times, this darkness that we're experiencing on the planet, there is this spark of light that wants to ignite within us? In my ministerial classes, we start off with a little cartoon video that we show the ministerial hopefuls. And it's called Match Scratch Fever. And it's the story of a matchbox. And the matchbox opens and there's this little match. And the little match realizes that I'm nobody unless I'm fire, but he can't get his fire to go. And then he realizes that he has to take his little head and he goes against the box, and all of a sudden he's a flaming match. Now, Mark Nepo uses the metaphor of the match too. He says, could we ignite the gifts that each of us has? That's where the light comes out. We all have gifts that are unique to us, and then offer those gifts to the cry of the world, to the needs of the world. Could we offer our light to this world that's very dark right now? And to know that each one of us has a unique gift, each one of us that's unique to us, boy, and offer it in service. So I use these metaphors because maybe that playful child within you can hear something within us needs to be lit up, you know, to have, and that something is already the third phase of awakening. Then, according to Locke Kelly, is then you awaken out. Then you hear the cry of the world and you're here to serve. You're here to serve the water and the trees and the elephants and the whales. I've been deeply disturbed because I'm such an empath with this planet right now. And I saw in the news that 470 pilot whales had beached themselves off the coast of Australia. Over 350 made their transition. They were able to save 107. And what would cause a species to do that? And then I hear that off the coast of Portugal and Spain, the orcas are attacking the ships. So something is going on this planet. Something is trying to get our attention. Could we hear the cry of the world? Not with an idea that I got to fix it, but at least I've got to hear it and I've got to respond in a compassionate way. I shared with you, this is the last in a series of four talks on the wise heart. And in that wonderful book by Jack Kornfield, he talks about the necessity on the planet right now of the spiritual warrior. And you guys are the spiritual warriors, as am I. And in order to be a spiritual warrior, he said, the first thing is they have a lightheartedness. They realize that they have to have a playfulness in this universe. How are we going to navigate if we're so serious and fearful and concerned, if we can't say, okay, I need to jump in the water and maybe have a conversation with the whales or with the octopus or whatever. Have a playful spirit. And he says, and they're further known by their compassionate heart, because they realize it is all us. And then they have discipline, because they discipline their thoughts. They think positive thoughts. They're not against something as much as they're for something. They're not against this trauma on the planet, but they're for peace and for harmony and for love and for community and for caring for one another. That's a whole different way of being. And then he says, they're disciplined, but they're dedicated. I think of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I think of John Lewis. I think of Nelson Mandela, all dedicated to something greater than they are, equality for all people, you know, to fight the rightful cause. When something is wrong, to stand up, and this isn't acceptable. That's being dedicated to something. And lastly, all of these spiritual warriors recognize that there's the necessity of community, that we need to do this in community. The day of the lone wolf is over, as the Hopi prophecy said. Notice who's in the water with you, who's fighting the cause for something greater in this world. And hopefully those people are arising. I'm a little disheartened by this election that's coming up in less than 39 days, I think it is. But Jake over here gave me the most optimistic thing anybody could have given me. He said young people in the last election didn't think it meant anything for them to vote. But in this election, they do. And that little pearl, Jake, was a seed of hope. And Gene and I live with hope. That seed of hope is planted in my heart that we will recognize that we have to stand up. That the greatest nonviolent protest we can do is cast our vote and do it live at the ballot box. Wear your mask and be safe. Have you guys registered to vote here in Alabama? Yes? Good. I've got some new folks in the back and I love that. So let me start off by reading to you what these new eyes would look like. And I go back to my old buddy, Richard Rohr, because he says the whole problem is that we look with conditioned belief systems. It's like that woman who couldn't see with fresh eyes. And this is how he describes the shift that's required right now. He talks about living a life of contemplation, where you contemplate the facts of life from this bodhicitta, not from this mind that wants to make things right and wrong. So he says, contemplation allows us to see the truth of things in their wholeness, not as we perceive them, but this is all part of the wholeness that we're existing. He said, it's a mental discipline and gift that detaches us, even neurologically, from our addiction to our habitual way of thinking, to move from our left brain, which likes to think that's in control, and to slip into this right brain. You notice I do an awful lot of symbols and images and metaphors because that's the language of the right brain. That's what Jesus used. He said, I speak and they do not hear. So he would speak in parables. He would say things like, don't cast your pearls before swine. He wasn't talking about your mother's pearls. He'd say, stop looking for a beam that's a splinter in your brother's eye when there's a beam in your own. First, take the beam out of your own eye, and then you can see things more clearly. So again, using a different language in order for us to see differently. So Richard Rohr goes on to say, we stop believing our little binary mind. That's that little mind that says, I've got all the answers and everybody's wrong, but I'm right. He says, we move out of the binary mind, which strips things down to two choices and usually identifies with one of them, my way or the highway, and we begin to recognize the inadequacy of this limited way of knowing reality. In fact, he says, our binary mind is a recipe for superficiality. Go to a few rallies and you can hear superficiality. It's a recipe for superficiality, if not silliness. And he says, only the contemplative or the deeply intuitive mind can start venturing out into a much broader and more open-ended horizon. This is probably why Einstein said that imagination is more important than knowledge. Knowledge is limited and imagination encircles the world. So could we use our divine imagination to imagine a world? You know, on our Christmas candlelight service, we use that song of the Beatles every candlelight service. Imagine no religion, I wonder if you can. Imagine a world living peacefully with love from man to man. Imagine all these things. If we can imagine it, we can achieve it, right, Marie? So it starts with imagining a world that works for everyone, not just some exclusive group of people. We also have a poster of Einstein in the men's room. It's not the one that says imagination is greater than knowledge. It's the one that says, I don't want to know what man thinks. I want to know what God thinks. In order to do that, we have to get out of our little binary mind that has all the answers and step into this no mind that by its very nature is free of content, but yet is established in this context of an awareness that just gets bigger and more spacious, and we are the holding space for that context. So when the storm clouds appear, we're not so interested in the storm clouds. And when someone comes to you and says, you want to know what I think? You say, not really. I don't even want to know what I think. I want to establish myself in that holding space of a loving awareness that says, this too is good, this too is God, and I demand to see the blessing. And then the gift of the moment will reveal itself. Truly, I believe it is all a blessing, even this dark stuff. I'd love to share, I will share this with Jake, Jack Kornfield, this Buddhist teacher that I've been listening to. He says when someone will come to him and they're suicidal, he says the knee-jerk reaction is to say, oh, no, don't do that. Life is good. You don't need to take your life, da-da-da-da-da-da. And he says, but instead, what I say to them when they talk about taking their life, I say instead, what is it in your life that needs to die? Huh? Then it's a whole different question. Maybe it's a relationship that I'm having with somebody that's toxic and it needs to die. Maybe it's the church that I'm going to that says I'm an abomination in God's eyes. Maybe I need to step out of that and find a spiritual group that's more like me. So what is it that needs to die is a loving question. And then you realize that life is a series of deaths and rebirths. You know, I die daily to an old way of thinking in order to see in a new way. So I used to think I was here to fix the world and I had all the answers, but now I realize I don't have anybody's answers. All I can do is hopefully invite you to discover what's real for you, what's true for you. And the truth will unhide itself. It always does. It's right there at the core of your being. So he says, this is probably why, okay, I did the Einstein thing. And he goes on to say, to begin to see with new eyes, we must observe and usually be humiliated by the habitual way we encounter each and every moment. Have you ever had that slap by the universe? Oh my God, the only problem here was me. I was in a horrible relationship in college and I stayed and I stayed and I stayed and I stayed because I thought I could work it out. And then one day I heard a Peggy Lee song. I wanted the music to play on forever. Have I stayed too long at the fair? And I realized I was the only element in the problem here. I thought I could change somebody else. And once I realized this is done, I'd stayed too long, I left and I was free again. Free again, independent me, free again. You know, and so yeah, so you're humiliated. The habitual way we encounter ourselves. It's humiliating because we will see that we are well practiced in just a few predictable responses. Few of our responses are original, fresh, and his, the most common human response to a new moment is mistrust, cynicism, fear, knee-jerk reaction, and a spirit of dismissal and overriding judgmentalism. Anybody resemble that here? That knee-jerk reaction? And he says, I don't want to do that anymore. I don't want to hang out in that cynical place. So here, to let the moment teach us, he says, we must allow ourselves to be at least slightly stunned by what is until it draws us inward and upward toward a subtle experience of wonder. It's waking us up. Life is waking us up. And some of us need more of awakening than others. He goes on to use the example of Moses. Remember, this is a Franciscan monk. He says, Moses was going through his life, working on himself, and all of a sudden it says the bush was lit up from within, but it was not consumed by the light. And then he heard this voice within himself, the voice of God within, that says, take off your shoes, Moses, right where you stand is holy ground. And then people, I'm sure, thought Moses was crazy, but he was having a direct experience with the light that we all are. And this is how Rohr describes it. Moses was struck by awe. He takes off his shoes and the very earth beneath his feet becomes holy ground because he has met beingness itself. He met it within himself. He's meeting it within the world. In our class on Wednesdays, we're covering Brooke Medicine Eagle, a shamanic teacher, and she talked about the three attentions, very similar to this. She said the first attention, she said, imagine you're in a circle and you're holding hands with people and someone's beating a drum. And then the first attention is you lift your leg up and you're aware of the body. You're aware that I am a being, a physical being. And then he says, you put your foot down on the earth, and the earth is the second attention. I am connecting to the mother. I and the mother are one. I and the father are one. Then the third attention, he says, she says, you look around that circle where the drum is beating, and you realize I am Al, and I am Jake, and I am Judy, and I am Hank, and I am Gigi, that this is all me. The third attention, that we're all connected. Moses is having the same kind of direct experience. So this narrative reveals a classic pattern that's repeated in different form and varied lives and vocabularies among the world's mystics. The spiritual journey is a constant interplay between moments of awe, followed by a general process of surrendering into that moment. The universe is waking us up. Holy cow, and we're listening. We must first allow ourselves to be captured by the goodness, truth, and beauty of something beyond ourselves that's awakening within ourselves. Huh. And he goes on to say, the way to any universal idea is to proceed through a concrete encounter. There are a number of ways to say the same thing. The one is the way to the many. The specific is the way to the spacious. The now is the way to the always. The here is the way to the everywhere. The material is the way to the spiritual. It's all God getting our attention in the many different forms. The octopus is the way to love. I talked about that last week. And when we see contemplatively, we know that we live in a fully sacramental universe where everything is a pointer and everything is an epiphany. Everything is pointing to God. Meister Eckhart said, he who can see God in the smallest of things is better than seeing an angel. To see God everywhere. Last week, I shared with you in The Awakened Heart that beautiful Netflix documentary called The My Octopus Teacher. And it was all about this connection that we have to one another when we realize that we're not separate. That when this young man decided, when he started listening to his heart, he recognized that there was this ache and this longing to return to the water. He was like Gigi. He had been living in the Kalahari Desert for 20 years. He was doing his job, a documentary guy, and his heart ached to be near the salt water again. So being that he was from Africa, he went to South Africa, right at the tippy tip, and he decided to get in his Speedo, and he's into the ice cold water in the kelp forests. And he said, I wanted no separation. I didn't want to wear the wetsuit. I didn't want to wear the tanks. I wanted to experience the cold. He said, after a while, my body started to ache for the cold. I felt like I was coming home. And as he went into the mystery of the kelp forest, he found that they had different kinds of kelp forests. They had the ones that were like trees and the ones that were dense. There was the water that was murky and then the water was clear. And he found the cove that spoke to his soul. And every day religiously, he went back with his little camera and he went into the silence. And it wasn't within, I think, 12 days, he met the octopus coming out of her den. And he was curious, and he went down there every day to check on the octopus. And she was afraid of him, but she'd look at him with her eye. And before you know it, after day 32, her little tentacle came out, and she starts caressing his finger. By day 52, she came out of the den, and she was following him around. He dropped his camera. She was afraid. Her instinct took her back to the den. And it took another 52 days for her to trust him again. But he found that through his investigation, he found how she lived, and he started to think like the octopus. And after 120 days, she came out, she trusted him again, and she placed herself across his chest. And this is that kind of way of seeing things differently. You know, he stayed with her for over 300 days as the magic of the two began to work one another. It was a language of love that we humans don't know. It was a language of connection and belonging. And who was the teacher there? You could ask that question. So could we allow ourselves to discover something that is so filled with awe and wonder? You know, I have a hard time saying that, awe and wonder, that it begins to actually speak a language that's been trying to get our attention for a long time. When I was going through my meltdowns for the years, Al's been around, Judy's been around watching me do this, I needed to ground myself. And so what I found was so therapeutic for David was to grab a shell and to feel the connection to a shell, or to carry a rock around with me and know that the rock was, it was that second attention. It's the mother that's holding me. I think I'm holding the rock, but in a strange sort of way, the rock is holding me. I remember when Gigi came back from Bali, I think it was where she went, or Tahiti. And I said, what's your most treasured possession? And she takes this little tiny pebble on her table, and she holds this pebble up. And I was speaking to my own self here. Sometimes the smallest of things can be enough. You don't have to bring back, you know, a huge piece of art, a little stone from a sacred place. Gigi brought me back a shell from Hilton Head, and I've been listening to the ocean inside her. So what if you have to be a little crazy to connect with the universe and a little bit playful to find the wonder and awe? I'm gonna give you back into the real world. Mark Niebuhr wrote a wonderful book called The Way Under the Way. And he's a man that speaks from the heart. And he talks about meeting the world with different eyes in a way that's really refreshing. And I'm just going to give you a little taste of him, The Way Under the Way. And this is called The Place of True Meeting. And he talks about the way under the way, it's never the way we think it is. Everything visible rises out of a greater invisible force that brings us into being. So as we meet the form, could we meet the invisible within the form? Could we meet the consciousness within an octopus? Could we meet the presence within a shell? So he says, when the hardships of living make us forget that there is more to life than those hardships as a way of being, then we begin to shift and we return to the way under the way. To our constant surprise, enduring our hardships, which involves opening to our pain, opening to fear and loss, rather than sealing them over, is how we drink from the waters of life. So it's not about running away from what life brings us, but it's about truly opening to all of that. Opening to the fear and find that there's light in the fear, there's faith in the fear. Opening to the anxiety and find if we really open to anxiety, the other side of it is happiness. They're not two sides of a coin. Right within the anxiety, there's a sense of calmness. So here's how he says we meet all this. It's archetypal that we all try to distinguish ourselves in the first half of life. Ram Dass calls this our somebody training. We try to find our unique gifts and our contribution to the world and how we might succeed and be somebody, trying to discover how special we are, how different, how extraordinary we are. He says, but eventually we're transformed by experience to seek what we have in common with all life, in order to experience our ordinariness, which is our extraordinariness. You know, that little octopus didn't think she was really special. She was just a little octopus in her den. And all of a sudden, her lover came courting at her every day. I'd probably fall in love with that little diver if he came to my den every day and was looking at me with his camera and sticking his finger out and wanting to pet me. And yeah, so he says, we have, eventually we're transformed by experiencing to seek that we have in common with all life. So we might discover our one true kinship with one another. This shift from trying to be special to seeking what is special in everything marks the way under the way. It's all special. Nothing is special. Everything is special. So by its very nature, what keeps us alive defies being named. Though I try and I'll keep trying to define it, what keeps us alive defies being named. Like a whale that's compelled to break surface in order for itself to breathe. Also, like the whale who is compelled to go back down into the deep and to live in its element. How alive we truly are depends on the way under the way. So we're like that whale that comes up and takes a breath and explores, and then we're like that whale who goes down deep within ourselves, waking in and waking out and waking in and waking out. The way under the way is not what we thought it was. It's not about becoming somebody special, somebody who's achieved a great deal of. I was speaking to my prayer partner. He's going to be doing a live thing for a Colorado church that's in need of a minister. And he said, at this stage of my life, he's 74, I have the grace of speaking the truth. I don't have to hide and speak a company line. And he said, there's something beautiful about being at a certain age of life where you know you've evolved to this place where I become more of a holding space than an overachiever who's defining myself by the world's opinion. And the world's validation. There comes a place where you're not seeking so much the world's validation as you are absolving it to yourself. Am I living the authentic life that this soul learns to express? So he's saying the same thing. Could we be willing to have that shift so it's not really about me as somebody separate and special, but it's about me as being connected to everyone and everything? Now that to me is the way of the wise heart. And that's the way of seeing that's so needed on the planet right now, that everything is a reflection of our own self. Someone asked me, is it okay to call someone an a-hole? And I said, yeah, of course it is, as long as you do it from the a-hole within yourself. It's only the inner a-hole that knows the outer a-hole. You know, it's only the inner judge that can see an outer judge. And when you do, you're playing the God game. Because if we're seeing the enemy out there, that's why Jesus in his wisdom said, love the enemy, because we're merely projecting our own unhealed stuff out there in the world, and we're blaming it on them. When in truth, they're just showing us our own self. When my mother used to come and visit, my buttons would get pushed within the first half hour. Everybody loved her. Judy loved her. She was a lovely lady, but she pushed my buttons like nobody could push them. And I remember telling Trey, I said, I don't know, but she hasn't been here half a day and I'm already a mess. And I said, she's just pushing all my buttons. And then Trey, in his kind of crazy wisdom, he said, that's because she installed them. And when he said that, I went, oh, of course she knows how to push my buttons. And then I had a sense of humor around it. And I could say, that's just mom. And that's just the way we have our dynamic. And then I was playful again. This is about how we meet, how we navigate through life. And if you don't have a sense of humor, you're doomed. So lastly, I want to give you, and this is for you, Jake, The Joy of Meditation by Jeff Foster. This is a young man that I met who spoke to my soul so deeply because he reminded me that I can't see clearly. You know that beautiful song, I can see clearly now, the pain is gone. I can see all the obstacles in my way. Gone are the dark nights that had me blind. It's going to be a bright, bright, sunshiny day. The only way I can see clearly now is by meeting the dark clouds that had me blind, and don't run away from them. If I deny them, which is what I used to do in religious science, I deny all that stuff, then that stuff becomes subjective and it sabotages me. So here's how he put it so beautifully, and I'm going to use this as the segue to our closing meditation. And for those of you who like to carry rocks, it's called Standing Strong Like a Rock. Don't focus, he says, on what's wrong with the world. When you fight against a broken world, when you live in resistance, there is an inner violence and you contribute to the outer violence that you see. So this world is broken right now and it's struggling, and we don't help it by attacking it. He says, instead, see the world as it is. The way an artist would look at a face, with all of its flaws, its imperfections, its ridges, its bumps, its crevices, its creases. So see the light and the dark, the love and the fight from love, the kindness and the forgetting of kindness. See it all with a sense of fascination and curiosity, and love the world now for how it appears. You know, I said to someone, you know, everybody's doing the best they can with what they have. And I believe that this planet is doing the best it can with what it's has. My prayer partner told me that Prime Minister Trudeau in Canada announced that they're going electric. They're going to spend $2 billion on making electric cars, electric planes, and they're getting off fossil fuel. Wow, how revolutionary is that? He says, love the world now for how it appears, and hold the world in your loving arms. She is young and she's making mistakes, but know that she's learning. Isn't that wonderful to hold the world in your arms? Irina Treaty used to do a prayer. It's a Sufi prayer. She says, take the suffering world into your heart and then offer your heart to God. You know, it's just a little metaphor, but doesn't it feel right? I don't have to fix the world, but I can take it into my compassionate heart. So he goes on to say, and from this place of love, then we re-enter the world and we stand strong like a rock. The rock doesn't have to judge and make the world wrong. We stand strong like a rock, illuminating the world with our simple, powerful presence. It's enough to be who you are and to offer your beingness to this planet, to show up with your radiant smile and your gentle touch. Speak up for those without a voice, he writes. We need more John Lewis's. We need more Ruth Bader Ginsburg's. We need more Nelson Mandela's. Amplify the message of understanding and compassion, and then spread this truth. To speak the truth, hesitatingly from your lips, but speak the truth, because the truth sets us free. You know, that we belong to one another, that we're here to serve one another, to love one another. A friend of mine was having an argument with a Christian who was saying a lot of crazy things, and he said, well, didn't he just teach love? Something I would have probably said, and to which this person said, it's too hard to love. And then he commented, well, didn't he teach forgiveness? Well, it's too hard to forgive. And then my crazy friend said, well, didn't he just teach to do good to others and da 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 da? Apparently the person couldn't hear the message. So fight for what you know and dare to speak the truth with love, not against what you impose or reject. I'd love to quote Gandhi, who says, I'm not against the British rule here in India. I'm for the Indian people having autonomy over their own voting rights, you know, to be for something and against nothing. And I'll show you an individual who changed the world. He goes on to say, your attention is your greatest blessing. So bless the world that you are birthing now with your loving attention, and do not energize a dying world with your intolerance. Some of this world is dying. Could we hospice that which is dying and then midwife that which is wanting to give birth? I believe that the best parts of us is wanting to give birth on this planet where we learn to love one another. Know that everyone is an aspect of ourselves. So here's his last little phrase. He says, get together with your brothers and sisters. This is the understanding of the necessity of community. Discover who your true family is. I'm looking at it right now. Beyond color, beyond race, beyond religion, beyond belief, and unite with them in the name of love. So let's close off our month-long series on the wise heart by uniting in that open heart, the sacred heart, the heart of the one that knows no other. And as we enter into this sacred heart, we just allow it to open, knowing that there are no boundaries to this heart space, the spiritual heart. And we open first to the heart of one another in this room, perhaps, and we make that incredible connection to one another. We open to the heart of the mother, to this earth. I've been speaking a lot about the planet today. So feel your connection to this planet, this mother that's truly, we are made out of her. And feel that connection to the 12,000, the 10,000 things, all the different forms of life that exist on this planet, even the inanimate ones like a rock, because a rock knows it's a rock. And a rock carries a deep ancestral knowing of the many millions of years that it's been on this planet. So instead of thinking that we are superior, could we stand strong like a rock? Could we be open and giving like a tree, allowing our boughs to be a home for birds and squirrels and all kinds of life? Could we, like the tree, reach to the stars, reach to the light, and yet be rooted so deeply in the dark, deep mother, the depths of consciousness? Breathing in and breathing out. Without the trees, we wouldn't be here. They're our ventilator on the planet. They're giving us oxygen. And so we see the trees with different eyes. We see this planet with different eyes. We see our attention as the most valuable thing we have, and so we are conscious of where we are putting our attention. Are we putting our attention on a vision that's greater than we are, that's in service to the one? Or are we putting our attention on those habitual thoughts and concerns and judgments and things that we tell ourselves? We take responsibility for who is looking through our eyes. And we're so grateful that we can see clearly now, beyond the fog of yesterday's belief systems. We can see clearly now because the pain is gone, the pain of struggle, the pain of resistance, the pain of expectation and attachment. Gone are the dark clouds that had us blind. We're not looking at the clouds and calling them real, but we have surrendered and found ourselves in that spacious field of awareness, the sky. Gone are the dark clouds that had us blind. And then we see the light emerging from the darkness, and we affirm it's going to be a bright, bright, sunshiny day, because I've changed the way I perceive the world. I'm seeing the light even amidst the dark times. And I realize that the only way we can midwife the light is by allowing this light, this gift that we are, to be struck up against the cry of the world like a match, and then we can burn brightly. Rumi said, my life consisted of three things. I burned, I burned, I burned. So to know ourselves as this light that's burning brightly, we bring our light to the darkness. We bring our love to the fear and the anger. We bring our peace to the anxiety and the confusion. And in this way, we serve by being the embodiment of the very thing that we long for. Feeling that connection to that heart space, I invite you to place your hands over your heart, accessing this essence self that we all share. It's not unique to each one of us. It's not special to each one of us. It's unique to each one of us, and yet it's the same presence. So to this loving presence, this namaste within, let's say, I honor you.
I honor you.
I respect you.
I respect you.
I love you.
I love you.
You are the deepest aspect of myself.
You are the deepest aspect of myself.
I see you everywhere in the world.
I see you everywhere in the world.
I place my hands in prayer fashion and I bow to you. In this place, we are one. And so it is. And so from that oneness, let's open our eyes, open our hearts. Let's return to the holiness of this moment with gratitude in our hearts. I want to thank you all for tuning in, for sending in your tithes, for praying for the planet, and for lending your light to the world, which it so desperately needs right now. We're in this together. And as my friend Anne-Marie says, we will get through this.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. More information, please visit www.cslhuntsville.org. To create a brand new